Good afternoon, everybody. It's wonderful to see so many of you for such a special occasion at SACPA yet again. I'm your moderator, Klaus Jericho. And before I start introducing the speaker, I want to send a few words of praise and acknowledgement to SACPA's organizers in the past and the present. I think they have done an outstanding job for this community. As Gordon Gamble said, you know, without debate, democracy is in trouble. And that's really what has driven him to organize this for about 35 years. And it's true, I think it has left a real mark in society, an assessment of desperate society. So it's just wonderful. And they're not afraid of put on large subjects or small subjects. It's just amazing. Of course, today we have one subject which is very difficult to make any larger. We're talking about life over time, over a long time. So that's what it's really all about. The website should help everybody to keep in contact with SACPA. It gives you the audio of these presentations, and you can also get the titles of forthcoming presentations. And you can also make comments and keep the debate going on the internet. This is one part of two parts, because next week the talk is on a related subject matter, a very much related subject matter, and it will be given by Larry Dye, who has been in faith ministry for 20 years, and he will be focusing on faith-based creationism and the process of life, whereas today we are getting the science point of view of the process of life over time. And we are very fortunate not only to have SACPA, but we are also very fortunate to have real talent in this town to give us this information and these talks. And we have Dr. Bryson Brown today from the University of Philosophy. He has been talking here at SACPA once or twice before on science and religion and science and in general. So he is no newcomer to this organization. I looked up in the Oxford Dictionary as to what philosophy means, and it's a love, study, or pursuit of wisdom, or of knowledge of things and their causes, whether theoretical or practical. Well, that sort of embraces more or less all curiosity, doesn't it? So most of you, I suspect, who are sitting here, and our faithful supporters of SACPA, you're all philosophers as far as I'm concerned. But Bryson Brown, he's a very good one. He is a very good one. He has a PhD in it. He has written books about it, written articles about it. And he teaches philosophy from the point of view, from the perspective of science and so on. And I have audited his classes, and I tell you, he's a dynamic speaker. He's just awesome. So, as I said, today it's science and the evolution of life over time. And next week it's faith-based creationism. So without any further ado, I asked Bryson, would you please come up and summarize all of life in the next 25 minutes, please?
Thank you, Klaus. It might be worth my saying that one of the reasons that I chose to study philosophy when I started undergraduate studies was because my interests were too general to be confined to any particular sort of area, and philosophy gave me an excuse to take an interest in just about anything. Evolution is one of the things that I've taken an interest in for a very long time now, and of course, I'm sure you don't expect me to present you with a full synopsis of the evidence for evolution in 20 minutes or so. I'm going to be very choosy. I'm going to pick one central theme in the evidence for evolution and talk about that. But before I start talking about the evidence for evolution in any concrete way, I want to talk briefly about evidence and register a caveat, a little warning, before we carry on to the actual evidence. So, Theodosius Dobzhansky is an important evolutionary biologist of the early to mid-20th century. And he said once, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." What did he mean by that? I think he meant something like this. Evolution is the thread that ties the phenomena of biology together. And without evolution, biology would include many facts. There are many things that we can observe about the biological world without supposing evolution. But they would be disconnected facts. And they would be unexplained facts. We wouldn't understand them. Now, the idea of evidence for scientific theories, it's a complicated notion. I mean, how do you get from what would happen to this little laser pointer? I won't do it, but what would happen to it if I let it go? We all have a pretty clear idea of what it will do. It's going to fall. But it's a long way from that to Newton's theory of gravity as a force that is proportional to the masses of two bodies and inversely proportional to the distance between, to the square of the distance between them. That's, you know, a fairly complicated bit of mathematics that involves geometry and space as well as just what objects do when you let them go, and turns out to explain many other things like the tides and the orbits of the moons of Jupiter and the orbits of the planets around the sun. So what I want to say here in general is that what counts in favor of a scientific view of things is how well the various kinds of evidence fit with that thing, fit with that view, and how they fit with its rivals. You have to think also in terms of the alternative views. Good evidence is going to support a view when that view can predict the evidence in some way. We knew about the tides to some extent before Newton. We observed them, but we had no general understanding of them or why they had a sort of regular association with the orbit, with the position of the moon, and also an association with the sun and the relative position of the sun and the moon in the sky. Those things we didn't really understand until Newton came along and said, well, you know, what it has to do with, what's driving this rise and fall in sea level is the gravitational influence of these bodies. And that provides an explanation of the timing and the patterns of higher and lower tides and so on and so forth through the seasons and the years. Strong evidence for a view is the kind of evidence that isn't anticipated by its rivals, something that this view predicts, but its rivals don't really give us any way of predicting. And often, in fact, it can't even be explained by its rivals except through ad hoc stipulations. That's when we sort of make something up. We add some extra bits to the rival to make sure that it now encompasses this fact. Sometimes that's very hard to do. And in that case, then we have very strong evidence for a particular view, the view that does succeed in giving a good account of the facts. Now, philosophers have dealt with skepticism for a long time. There have been skeptical arguments on the table in the philosophical discussion since the ancient Greeks. One in particular that's very famous due to Sextus Empiricus. It's called the problem of the criterion. Now, if we apply these arguments generally, if we just take them at face value and accept their conclusions, then the result is we have no grounds at all for believing anything. Sextus Empiricus' arguments are that strong. So I have no reason to believe that I'm holding anything in my hand here or that I'm actually standing in front of a crowd or so on and so forth. That's where radical skepticism leads. Now, some people try to apply these same arguments to views that they just don't like. So if you see evidence for a view that you really don't want to accept, one thing that you can do if you don't like it is to say, well, you know, you could be wrong about that. There are all kinds of ways you could be wrong about that. Why don't we start listing the ways that you could be wrong about that? And pretty soon you're ignoring the evidence and talking about ways we can be wrong about, well, just about anything. This is what happened to Semmelweis when he tried to tell the doctors in a maternity ward that their failure to wash their hands after the dissections in the morning was spreading disease to women in the maternity wards in the afternoon. It's a 19th century issue. And he was actually driven out of the profession over that. So, you know, people can do this. You can selectively apply skeptical arguments and refuse to really pay attention to the evidence if you like. But, of course, that's cheating. Either the skeptical arguments work, and we really know nothing whatsoever, which is not a position I think any of us finds attractive, or the skeptical arguments fail, and we have to pay attention to the evidence. You can't just pick and choose which evidence you ought to pay attention to. Oop, that didn't work there. Now, I want to talk briefly about this notion of consilience, which is the title of a book by E.O. Wilson some years ago, but the notion goes back to William Ewell. He's a 19th century English philosopher of science and scientist himself, really. What he meant by consilience was what happens when there are a number of separate inductions that count in favor of a particular view. So separate bits of evidence or lines of evidential thinking that count in favor of a view that all jump together. Not jumped, but jump together, to support that view. They all give, they give you a kind of coherent, unified picture of a whole bunch of separate lines of evidence, each of which would be evidence for the view, but the view actually covers all of them. So that's consilience. And he thought Newtonian physics was a great example of this, because Newtonian physics, in terms of just the theory of gravity alone, accounts for planetary orbits and satellite orbits, the orbits of the moons of Jupiter, which were observed by Galileo, falling bodies and tides, and quite a few other phenomena as well. So each of these is described by its own inductive regularities, its own pattern, which we can see follows the rules that we would expect from Newton's theory. So separately, each one of these is a family of phenomena that supports Newton's theory. But Newton's theory encompasses all of them in one nice, neat package. You know, the laws of motion plus the law of gravity. Evolution also accounts for many different patterns in the biological facts. So I want to say evolution is like Newtonian physics in this way. There are two key ideas in evolution. There's also another, which we'll get to at the end. But if we're just talking about evolution, we're talking about descent with modification. That was Darwin's phrase, the idea that in a long lineage of descent from ancestors to descendants, the descendants can wind up different, noticeably different from the ancestors. And we know that from just the fact that when we practice agriculture and selectively breed crops or animals, the descendants, in a pretty short period of time, in a fairly small number of generations, can be substantially different from the ancestors. And it also involves descent from common ancestors. There's a hypothesis about the story of life on Earth over time, as Klaus was saying. Evolution involves the idea that organisms that are clearly separate lineages today, that don't interbreed today, once had common ancestors. And that the populations that descended from those common ancestors became separate over time in one way or another and changed in different ways over time, so that as you get descent with modification along one line and descent with modification along the other line, you wind up eventually with two organisms or two groups of organisms, two populations, which are quite different and don't interbreed at all, even when they share the same territory. And one important type of evidence for evolution that I think illustrates the idea of consilience is the agreement of the distinct, separate trees of life. There's a tree of life which we find in taxonomy, a tree structure that's represented in taxonomy. There's a tree of life that we find in development. There's a tree of life that we find in biogeography when we look at the distribution of different kinds of organisms around the world. There's a tree of life that we find in paleontology when we study fossil organisms over time and how we see different fossils characteristic of different periods. And there's a tree of life in biochemistry when we look at the details of DNA sequences, protein sequences, and so on. Now, Linnaeus is where I'll start talking about taxonomy. He developed a hierarchical taxonomy based on observable features of organisms. This was a shift. This was a shift to something much more recognizably like modern science. Because rather than pay attention to the uses of these organisms, whether they were food animals or crops that we tended or medicinal plants or et cetera, And rather than think in terms of their symbolic associations, the associations of lion, the association of lions with kings, or of lambs with meekness, Linnaeus was interested in organizing and associating organisms together based on their own intrinsic resemblances in terms of their physical properties. He was also the first to develop a uniform binomial nomenclature for species. So each species in science is named with a genus name, which is capitalized, and a species name, which is lowercase. And that name is unique for every species. And that's very useful if you want to identify kinds of organisms and talk about them in the scientific context. You've got to be able to exchange information. So, you know, you don't want to just talk about dogs. You want to talk about Canis familiaris. Or, well, you don't want to just talk about fruit flies because you might be confused about which fruit fly you meant. So maybe you'll talk about Drosophila melanogaster and so on. It's just a way of having a precise name that everybody knows picks out a particular kind of organism, and you know what the criteria are for assigning an organism to those groups. And his work marked the beginning of an explosion of knowledge about different species of plants and animals. And this is in the 17th, 18th century, and this is late in the age of exploration when scientists were beginning to accompany some expeditions and to record observations and to take notes and to bring home specimens. And so we began to realize for the first time just how many different species of plants and animals there were spread out around the world. So here's an illustration of the taxonomic hierarchy. This is the famous Australopithecus afarensis fossil, also called Lucy. So we have species, which is the sort of lowest level taxon. Species afarensis, genus, Australopithecus, which means southern ape. Family Hominina, that's the family of organisms that are all descended from the last common ancestor that diverged from the chimpanzees and is the common ancestor of us today. So it includes the Australopithecines. Order Primates, includes a lot of organisms, apes, monkeys, new and old world, lemurs, and so on. And then class Mammalia, all the mammals. Then we gather them together under the phylum Vertebrata, because there are lots of other organisms that have spines other than the mammals. The kingdom Animalia and the domain Eukaryota, those are the organisms that have eukaryotic cells, cells that have nuclei, and apparently developed through, in part, symbiosis with other organisms when they were single-celled. What kind of conclusions do we draw from this tree? This is the local induction just based on the taxonomic tree. Life is not naturally ordered in a linear way. That's a long tradition, by the way, in philosophical and earlier scientific thinking about life. There was a tendency to think in terms of ladders. There was a tendency to talk about the chain of being, which is one of the great figures of philosophical comment on the order of nature. The chain of being was supposed to reach from what some people called monads, the very simplest forms of life, all the way up to us, and then on to God. It was a kind of continuous link, each joined to the next, each a step up the scale in complexity, in perfection. But when you look at how taxonomy actually gets done, when you actually look at the features that organisms have and group them together according to features that they share or don't share, and distinguish them according to what they don't share, we don't find a linear ordering. We find a kind of bushy tree. So we class fairly closely together, if we look at the world today, with other great apes, chimpanzees and the gorillas, and somewhat more distantly with the orangutans, and those are clearly distinct from the monkeys because, among other things, they've all given up tails, as we have, and there are other much more technical anatomical features that distinguish them from other primates, and then you sort of go down the taxonomic tree, including wider and wider groups based on similarities that are more and more widely shared. And the tree is objective. We aren't just making this up, because you can do this same tree based on quite different anatomical features. So it's not just, as I say, in terms of, say, brain size that you can say that the great apes make a group. It's also in terms of much more detailed skeletal features of their anatomies, and you can pick different features and you'll still come up with the same groupings. So it's an objective feature of the living world that they group in these ways. Our taxonomy looks, in fact, quite a lot like a family tree. And this view of taxonomy predates and is independent of the idea of evolution. This notion of how to do taxonomy was adopted and put into practice very systematically and thoroughly long before people started to think, well, maybe this is some kind of evidence for evolution. Now, development. This is the second tree. Ernst von Baer, this is early to mid-19th century, noticed a pattern when he was looking at embryos as they developed, and he was looking at embryos of animals. And he was interested in whether there were parallels between them or whether there were differences between them and when those differences showed up in the course of development of these embryos. And what he discovered is that there's a kind of branching pattern to the course of development. At first, we will talk about the triploblasts, which is the group that includes us and just about every other animal you can think of. It leaves out the jellyfish and their sort of cousins, cnidarians and so on. The triploblasts begin by forming three layers, which are called the ectoderm, the outside, the mesoderm, the middle, and the endoderm, the inside. They all go through that stage. And then they go through further stages, which begin to branch out. And interestingly, they branch out in the order of the main branches of the taxonomic tree. So that you can tell quite early on whether one of these developing embryos is developing towards being something like a fly, an arthropod, right? Or whether it's developing towards being something like a clam, right? A mollusk. And then later on, if you want to know what family of clams this clam that's developing belongs to, later on it will show features that distinguish between one kind of clam, one family of clams, and one other family of clams. Later on, it'll show differences that distinguish between one genus of clams and another genus of clams. And later on, it will develop the features that distinguish it as a member of a particular species of clam. So that during development, animals follow a path essentially up the tree of taxonomy to the point where they finally show features that identify them as belonging to a particular species. This is another tree that we see in biology. It's different from the taxonomic tree. The taxonomic tree was based on the anatomy of adults. But that tree shows up again in this pattern of development. Biogeography. This is sort of early, mid-19th century. This is what Darwin was doing on the beagle. Biogeography is the study of how life is distributed around the world. Now, in the 19th century, as I said earlier, the scientific explorers were beginning to actually come up with systematic collections of living things from different places and bringing them back and consulting with other taxonomists, looking at the specimens and assigning them to their places in the growing taxonomic tree of life as it was being built. And Darwin's work on the beagle made some very major contributions to this field. Islands, in particular, this is one of the standard observations that people made, often had unique species. Species that were clearly distinct from species anywhere else. But those species belonged to genera that were found on especially the nearest continental landmasses. That was kind of striking, because they were clearly different species, and yet the species you find in an island are the species that are coming from the nearby mainland, or at least are related to species that are on the nearby mainland. And they're related in other interesting ways. For instance, very rarely on oceanic islands do you find amphibians. So there were a number of interesting patterns in how life is distributed around the world. Plants and animals in a region, too. Plants and animals within a particular area, even again when they belong to different species, often bear a family resemblance to each other. Darwin discovered a new species of rhea in South America. Brought it back to England, didn't really know because he wasn't an expert on that. But showed it to an ornithologist, and the guy said, oh, this is a new species of rhea. And it's named for Darwin now. So there you are. In South America, you find a new species of rhea. In South America, Darwin also found fossils of diptodons, which were ancient, gigantic armadillos about the size of Volkswagens. But they were clearly armadillos, and not just in sort of overall, you know, this sort of leathery armor on them, but also in terms of detailed skeletal features. So the same goes for fossil life in these areas. So there were biogeographic conclusions to draw, and these were drawn roughly in the mid-19th century. The plants and animals that we find around the world were not just set down where the climate and other conditions suited them. They were distributed in ways that suggested a kind of historical linkage between life as it is now in those continents and earlier species that are no longer around in those continents. And in nearby regions, you find similar forms of life, closely related forms of life. Across greater distances, you find much more different forms of life. The marsupials in Australia are a great example of that. And Wallace, Alfred Russel Wallace, this is before he came up with natural selection independently of Darwin, in 1855 wrote a long paper about these facts of distribution and declared this general empirical law. This wasn't anything that he was inferring from evolution, because he didn't believe in evolution yet. But he said, look, when you look around the world and you look at the paleontological record, what you see is that new species arise near in both time and space to pre-existing similar species. That's a pattern in biogeography. And I didn't say much about tree-ishness here, but this pattern is, you can sort of see trees. If you think of a continent as a branch, you find closely related species, you know, the leaves on that branch, all on that continent. So there is a tree-ish structure to biogeography as well. Paleontology. This is a popular one for the other side of this discussion. But they're mistaken. They're mistaken to make it a popular issue. In the 17th century, people like Steno, Hooke, and Leonardo da Vinci were arguing that fossils really are remains of ancient life. This was a controversial issue at first. But as you look at more and more samples and think about how the details fit together, including the details of what does get preserved and what doesn't get preserved, right? It's the hard parts regularly that get preserved. You very rarely find any kind of trace in the fossil record of soft parts. That's exactly what you would expect if these were organisms that had died and been buried and partly rotted. All the soft parts are gone, but, you know, part of the skeleton or the teeth in particular, which are, of course, the hardest parts of our bodies, persist. And so we have the fossils. In the late 18th century, William Smith and others began to notice that there's a regular sequence to the fossil record. Smith was a mining engineer and a canal engineer and a surveyor in England. The guy that first drew up and conceived the idea of a geological map tracing bedrock exposures across an entire country. There's even a book on that, 5 minutes. I won't go on any more about Smith. Cuvier and Brongniart extended his work in the Paris Basin, and they found, again, that when you look at layers of rock and how they're disposed, one above another, around the world, you find fossils characteristic of one period in a place, and you'll find them always in the same order. You don't always find every type of fossil in the whole history of fossil life on Earth in one particular place, but where you find them, you always find them in the same order in the stratigraphy. And there are cases, yes, where strata get overturned, but that's something you can actually diagnose by looking at the geology, and sometimes even by looking at the section where you can tell that this was an ancient sea bottom and it's been flipped. You can tell that it's upside down. So we find this same order everywhere in the geological record. And in the mid-19th century, Heinrich Braun did a review of this work, and he noticed that there was a tree structure in paleontology as well. That early fossils of a particular kind, say early fossils that we regard as early mammals, show general features that are very widely shared amongst all mammals today. And the specialized features that characterize particular groups of mammals only emerge later in the fossil record. And this, again, is somebody who's not committed to evolution. This is just somebody looking at the fossil record and identifying this tree pattern in the fossil record. So paleontological conclusions, life has changed over time. Life gradually becomes more familiar looking as we look at more recent formations, which is where we get the distinction between Paleozoic, Mesozoic, and Cenozoic. And this ordering predates and was independent of scientists accepting evolution. Occasionally you'll find people claim to the contrary, but that's just false. This was established long before people accepted evolution. But we also get the tree pattern that we found in taxonomy, development, and biogeography. And Braun noted the tree pattern, and that's what I just said a minute ago, so we'll skip that one. Biochemistry gives us the same tree back again. And these are techniques that we only developed in the 1950s and following, 1952, when we identified the structure of DNA molecules and began to unravel the puzzle, chemically speaking, of how inheritance works. We can now identify and sequence the genomes of organisms, including our own, and we can compare those genome sequences for different organisms, and when we do that, we get the same tree back again. Makes us closely related to chimpanzees, more distantly related to gorillas, so on and so forth. The same pattern of resemblance that we see in development, that we see in the fossil record, that we see in taxonomy, we also see in biochemistry, the same familiar tree. And in particular, the DNA code is highly conserved. It's pretty much the same for every organism, with small differences for certain bacteria and for our mitochondria, which are believed to be descended from bacteria that formed a symbiotic union with eukaryotic cells. The mechanism for producing vitamin C, this is a nice one, contains an identical error in chimpanzees and humans. There's an error in this piece of code, which is broken, right? We can't make vitamin C. Most mammals can, but we can't. It's broken in exactly the same way between chimpanzees and humans. So shared errors, just as they do in books, suggest descent. So there's Charles. And I think I'm just about out of time, so I'll just say that what we have here is another example of consilience. We have trees independently investigated and established on the basis of scientists working without the notion of evolution as a presumption. And those trees appear independently from different kinds of data, and they're all the same tree, and they're all explained quite easily in the same way as a product of descent with modification and descent from common ancestors. Darwin said, I'll close on this point. Darwin said during his work in the Origin of Species, and this is from the Origin of Species, there's only one cause that we clearly know that explains resemblance between different organisms. And that cause is descent from common ancestors. That's why all of us look so much alike. And that's why we are so similar to other mammals, in particular to the chimpanzees, but also in many, many ways to other mammals, and even to other vertebrates, including, as Neil Shubin titled his recent book, Your Inner Fish. Thanks, class.
Well, Bryson, you did it. You did it in 25 minutes. It's an awesome and clear review of the connectedness and the evidence and the connectedness of a biodiversity on life on the planet. Thank you very, very much. Now, I invite you all to partake in sandwiches and nutrition and have a good discussion and come up with some good questions thereafter. And please be reminded that for this privilege, you have to give us $10. Thank you.